on the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
You're listening to GRayRecords.com, your place for music plus more.
Okay, picture this. Sound isn't just invisible waves, it's physical. It's real spinning, this tangible tape running through guides, and you get this this incredibly warm, rich sound coming out. It's kind of hard to imagine now.
Yeah, before everything went digital, there was this amazing tech that, well, it didn't just capture sound, it really helped shape it.
It shaped whole decades of music, didn't it? Welcome everyone to The Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into something really fascinating. Reel-to-reel audio tape.
That's right. We've been digging through the sources you sent over. There's history, some deep technical stuff, and even what collectors and musicians are doing with it now.
So our plan is to sift through all that, pull out the really key insights, the most important bits, and sort of follow the whole journey of reel-to-reel. It's quite a story, from like a wartime invention to this beloved creative tool.
Okay, yeah, let's dive in. And the story, it really starts back in the 1930s in Germany.
Right, the magnetophone. That was AEG and BASF working together, wasn't it? AEG built the machine, BASF made the tape.
Exactly, and those very first tapes, they weren't the plastic stuff we might picture later. They actually used iron oxide powder coated onto paper, then they moved to plastic backing, which was, you know, much stronger.
Paper tape sounds incredibly fragile. Mm-hmm. And then World War II happens, and this technology takes a really unexpected turn.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. The German military used these magnetophones quite effectively for propaganda broadcasts. They could record speeches or music, make it sound completely live, but broadcast it later or repeatedly. Allied intelligence was apparently quite baffled by how they were doing it for a while.
Wow, so the war actually helped spread the technology.
In a way, yes. After the war, Allied forces captured some of these machines, studied them, and that knowledge basically seeded the development of magnetic tape recording industries in the US and elsewhere.
Which led to a kind of post-war boom for this tech.
A huge boom, especially in studios. You had companies like Ampex in the US, Studer in Europe, jumping on this, improving the design significantly.
Ampex seems like a key name here, especially for getting professional machines into American studios. And wasn't Bing Crosby involved somehow?
Oh, absolutely. Bing Crosby was pivotal, actually. He hated doing his radio shows live coast to coast twice. Recording onto discs was clumsy, hard to edit.
Right, he couldn't really edit discs easily.
Exactly. So he saw a demonstration of an early Ampex machine, realized it could solve his problem, and he actually invested heavily in the company. He became the first big American star to pre-record his radio shows regularly on tape, and the first to master commercial records onto tape, too.
That's incredible. So he wasn't just using it, he was funding it because he needed it. That must have really accelerated things.
It totally did. Being able to record, stop, edit, re-record parts, it changed everything for radio and music production. And that's why pretty quickly, by the 1950s, reel-to-reel was just, it was the standard for any serious recording studio.
Okay, so it's the standard. But then comes the next massive leap, right?
Yeah.
Multi-track.
Yeah, the 60s and 70s. That's when reel-to-reel technology enabled recording more than just one or two tracks. You could suddenly record drums on one track, bass on another, vocals on a third, maybe keyboards on a fourth. all on the same piece of tape, synchronized.
And that wasn't just like a convenience thing. It fundamentally changed how music was made.
Oh, completely. It's the birth of modern music production as we know it. You could layer parts, build complex arrangements, experiment endlessly in the studio in ways that were just impossible before.
You start thinking about the albums from that era.
Exactly. Think about The Beatles. Meet the Beatles was an early four-track recording. But then you get to Sgt. Pepper's.
Ah, Sgt. Pepper's.
Right. Using those Studer J37 four-track machines, they were layering sounds, bouncing tracks between machines, running tapes backwards. Just incredible innovation.
And Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, that dense atmospheric sound.
Definitely relied heavily on sophisticated consoles feeding multi-track tape machines like the Studer A80. And Led Zeppelin, that iconic drum sound on When the Levee Breaks from Led Zeppelin the IV.
The one recorded in the stairwell.
Yeah. At Headley Grange, microphones placed up the stairs, capturing that huge natural reverb, all recorded onto reel-to-reel. You can almost hear the tape compression contributing to that massive sound.
Or the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Sane, that famously raw, almost grungy sound.
Recorded in a basement in France, mostly on an Ampex MM1000 16 track, that sound is pure analog tape being pushed hard. It's got that warmth, that slight saturation.
Even in jazz, like Miles Davis's Kind of Blue.
Recorded beautifully on Ampex 300 series machines. Tape preserved the nuances, the dynamics, the clarity of those performances incredibly well.
Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, Frank Sinatra's classic vocal albums, they all owe their sound in part to this technology.
Absolutely. That depth, that warmth, the dynamic range, and maybe even some of the subtle compression or glue that tape imparts, it defined the sound of so much iconic music.
Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts a bit. How does it actually work? Forget the complex mechanics for a second. What's the basic idea?
Well, at its core, it's all about electromagnetism. You've got this plastic tape coated with tiny magnetic particles, usually iron oxide.
Okay.
When you record, the tape moves past a recording head. This head is essentially a tiny electromagnet connected to your audio amplifier. As the music signal changes, the magnetic field created by the head changes.
And that field magnetizes the particles on the tape as they pass by.
Exactly. It leaves a magnetic pattern on the tape that mirrors the shape of the sound wave.
Okay, so that's recording. How do you get the sound back out?
You run the tape past a playback head. Sometimes it's the same head, sometimes a separate one. This head is sensitive to magnetism. As the magnetic pattern on the tape moves past it, it induces a tiny electrical voltage in the head's coil.
And that voltage matches the original audio signal.
Precisely. You amplify that tiny signal, send it to speakers, and you hear your recording. Simple concept, but getting it right involves some clever mechanics.
Right, like making sure the tape moves smoothly and at the right speed. Mm-hmm. You mentioned some cheaper machines just pull the tape with the take-up reel.
Yeah, that was called spool drive. The problem is, as the take-up reel fills with tape, its diameter increases, so it starts pulling the tape faster and faster.
Ah, so the speed isn't constant. That would mess up the pitch, right?
Totally. Play a tape recorded like that on a machine with constant speed, and the pitch would go all over the place. That's why better machines, pretty much all serious machines, used a capstan drive system.
Okay, what's a capstan?
It's a precisely machined metal shaft that's driven by a motor at a very constant speed. The tape gets pinched between this rotating capstan and a rubber roller called a pinch roller.
So the capstan pulls the tape past the heads.
Exactly. The capstan determines the tape speed very accurately. The take-up reel motor just provides gentle tension to wind the tape neatly. And the feed reel usually has a light drag or back tension to keep the tape snug against the heads.
Okay, that makes sense. Consistent speed is key. Mm. And you mentioned speed itself, measured in IPS inches per second. Why different speeds?
Ah, IPS. That's probably the single biggest factor affecting the potential sound quality of an analog tape recording. The basic rule is faster speed means better quality.
More inches of tape per second equals better sound. Why?
Because you're essentially stretching the magnetic pattern out over a longer piece of tape. Think of it like resolution. A higher speed allows the tape to capture finer details, especially high frequencies.
Okay, better treble. What else?
Crucially, a better signal-to-noise ratio. Tape inherently has some background hiss. At faster speeds, the recorded signal level is effectively higher relative to that fixed noise floor. So, less hiss compared to the music.
Got it. Faster speed, more detail, less hiss. So why not always use the fastest speed?
Tape cost and recording time. Faster speeds use up tape much more quickly. So slower speeds were fine for things like dictation, long radio interviews where top fidelity wasn't the main goal. You could fit more hours on a single reel.
What were the common speeds then?
Well, the slowest consumer speed, also used in compact cassettes, was 1 and 78 IPS. Then 3 and 34 IPS was very common for home machines, offering reasonable quality. 7 and 12 IPS was the top home speed and also the slowest professional speed, often used for things like radio ads.
And for serious music recording?
That was typically 15 IPS. Mm. And the absolute best used for mastering or critical recordings where noise had to be minimized was 30 IPS. Fun fact, all those standard speeds are mathematically related, derived by having 30 IPS repeatedly.
Huh, interesting. So speed is huge, but were there other things affecting the sound quality?
Oh, definitely. Track width was one. Professional formats use wider tracks on the tape for each channel, which also improved the signal-to-noise ratio compared to narrow consumer tracks.
Okay.
Then there's the tape formulation itself, the type and density of the magnetic oxide particles. The backing material mattered. Too early tapes used acetate, which could become brittle. Later, mylar or polyester was much more stable and stronger.
Mylar, right.
Yeah. And of course, of the quality of the machine itself, how accurately it maintains speed, that's where you get issues like wow and flutter.
Wow and flutter. That sounds like pitch wavering.
Exactly. Short-term speed variations cause flutter. Longer ones cause wow. Then there's the alignment of the heads, the quality of the electronics. Lots of factors.
And the tapes themselves could degrade over time, couldn't they? You mentioned sticky shed syndrome.
Yes. The bane of tape archivists. It happens with certain tape formulations from mostly the 70s and 80s. The binder, the sort of glue holding the oxide particles to the plastic base, breaks down and absorbs moisture, becoming sticky or gooey.
And that gums up the machine.
Terribly. It sheds sticky residue onto the heads and guides. The tape screeches. Sometimes it stops completely. It can make a tape unplayable.
Is there any way to fix it?
There's a temporary fix, believe it or not. Carefully baking the tape in a low-temperature, controlled humidity environment, like a food dehydrator or a special oven, for several hours can often temporarily drive out the moisture and stabilize the binder long enough for one careful playback to transfer the audio.
Icky or master tapes, that sounds incredibly stressful.
It absolutely is. You get one shot, usually. Another tape issue is print through.
Print through, what's that?
That's when the magnetic signal from one layer of tape wound on the reel imprints itself onto the adjacent layers. So when you play the tape, you might hear a faint pre-echo or post-echo of the sound just before or after it actually happened.
Like a ghost sound. I think I've heard that on some old recordings.
Very possible. It's more noticeable with louder signals stored for a long time. That's actually why many professional studios started storing tapes tails out.
Meaning wound to the end.
Yeah. After the final playback or mixdown, they'd wind the tape fully onto the take-up reel without rewinding it. That way, any print through that occurred during storage would be post-echo, happening after the real sound, which is generally less musically disturbing than hearing an echo before the sound.
Clever trick. Okay, so hiss was a big inherent problem. Faster speeds helped, wider tracks helped. What else did they do? Noise reduction systems.
Exactly. Electronic noise reduction was developed to tackle the hiss and improve the dynamic range you could capture on tape. The most famous name here is Dolby.
Dolby, like on my old cassette deck. Dolby B or C.
That's the one. Dolby noise reduction used a clever process called companding. Basically, during recording, it would boost the level of the quiet sounds before they went onto the tape.
So the quiet parts got recorded louder. Closer to the louder parts.
Right. This pushed the quiet signals further above the tape's inherent noise floor, the hiss. Then during playback, the Dolby circuit did the opposite. It reduced the level of those boosted quiet parts back down to their original level.
And when it pushed the quiet sounds down, it pushed the hiss down with them.
Precisely. It effectively compressed the dynamic range going onto tape and expanded it coming off, lowering the noise in the process. Dolby A was the complex professional system. Dolby B became the standard for consumer cassettes. Dolby C was an improvement on a B. And Dolby SR was the ultimate professional analog system.
Were there others besides Dolby?
Yeah, DBX was another popular companding system. It offered even more noise reduction than Dolby B or C, but it was much more aggressive. Tapes recorded with DBX sound really weird if you play them back without the DBX decoder engaged. Telefunken also had a system called HiCom in Germany.
Okay, so studios had these amazing machines, but you mentioned home users too.
Oh yeah. From the 60s through the early 80s, reel-to-reel was a serious format for home audio files. You had great machines from companies like Teak, Akai, Revox.
And the sound quality was better than other home formats at the time.
Generally, yes. Especially running at 7 and 12 IPS, a good reel-to-reel deck could easily outperform vinyl LPs in terms of dynamic range and frequency response, and it was definitely superior to the early compact cassettes, particularly before Dolby B became widespread on cassettes.
So why didn't reel-to-reel dominate the home market then, if it sounded better?
Two words. Convenience and cost. Reel-to-reel machines were bulky, expensive, and crucially, you had to manually thread the tape every single time you wanted to play something.
Yeah. That does sound a bit fiddly compared to just popping in a cassette.
It was. For the average person, the slight hassle was a deal-breaker. When the compact cassette format got good enough, especially with Dolby noise reduction, and was just so much easier to use and portable, it basically killed off reel-to-reel for the mass market by the mid-80s.
Could you buy albums on reel-to-reel, like pre-recorded tapes?
You could, yeah. They actually started appearing pretty early, like 1949 in the US, 1952 in the UK, initially mono, often duplicated in real time.
Real time, so making one copy took as long as the album itself.
Yep.
Must have been a slow process. RCA Victor got involved. EMI tried some early stereo tapes, which were apparently super expensive and didn't sell well. The real heyday for pre-recorded reel-to-reel was probably the mid-1960s.
But they didn't last long either.
No, same reasons as the hardware. Once cassettes and 8-tracks arrived, offering more convenience and lower prices, pre-recorded reel sales plummeted. They cost significantly more than LPs. The selection of titles wasn't as wide.
So even though the sound might have been better.
Convenience and cost won again. By the mid-70s, most major labels stopped producing them. Columbia House, the mail order club, kept offering them until about 1984, believe it or not.
But there was a niche market later.
There was. In the late 70s and 80s, small audiophile labels popped up, like Barclay Crocker. They licensed music from major labels and released very high-quality reel-to-reel versions, often using Dolby or sometimes DBX noise reduction.
And they duplicated them differently. Yes, that was key. Instead of the high-speed duplication, like 16x or even 32x playback speed used for mass-market tapes, these audiophile labels duplicated them much slower, maybe only 4x speed or sometimes even real-time, to preserve maximum fidelity.
Quality over quantity.
Exactly. And incredibly, today, that niche has come back. There are companies like The Tape Project, Analog Productions, and others selling brand new pre-recorded albums on reel-to-reel tape, mastered from original analog sources, duplicated carefully at slow speeds, for hundreds of dollars per album.
Wow. So it went from mainstream format to obsolete to ultra-high-end luxury good.
Quite the journey. But maybe the most fascinating part of reel-to-reel isn't just playback, it's how it became a creative tool, an instrument almost.
Right, because you could physically mess with the tape, cutting and splicing.
Yes, that was the original form of audio editing. Before digital workstations, if you wanted to remove a cough, shorten a guitar solo, combine the best parts of two takes, you literally took a razor blade to the tape.
How did that work?
You'd find the exact spot you wanted to cut, often by rocking the reels back and forth over the playback head to hear the sound slowly. Then you'd mark the tape, place it in a metal splicing block that held it precisely, slice it with a razor blade, do the same for the other piece of tape you wanted to join it to, put the ends together in the block, and stick them with a special adhesive splicing tape.
That sounds painstaking.
Ugh.
Did the splices cause clicks or pops?
Sometimes. A straight 90-degree cut, a butt splice, could sometimes cause an audible click as it passed the head. Often editors preferred to make angled cuts, which made the transition slightly smoother and less abrupt. It was a real craft.
Okay, so editing was one huge thing, but you could do more creative stuff too, right? Effects.
Oh yeah. This is where artists really started pushing things. Les Paul was a giant here. He essentially invented multi-track recording using multiple tape machines before multi-track machines existed.
How did he do that?
He'd record, say, a rhythm guitar part onto one tape machine. Then he'd play that tape back, listen to it on headphones, and play a lead guitar part along with it, recording both the playback of the first part and his new live part onto a second machine.
Ah, so he was bouncing tracks from one machine to another, adding a layer each time.
Exactly, layering harmonies, guitar parts. He and Mary Ford built up incredibly complex recordings this way, and tape was reusable, unlike cutting discs, which was a huge advantage.
Didn't he also mess with the tape speed?
All the time. He'd record tracks at one speed and play them back faster or slower to change the pitch, shift octaves, create unusual textures. Ross Bagdasarian used the same trick, recording his voice slowed down and playing it back sped up to create the high-pitched voices for Alvin and the Chipmunks.
The Chipmunks, of course. That's pure tape speed manipulation.
Classic example. And echo and delay effects were born from tape too. Les Paul figured out you could feed the output signal from the playback head back into the input of the record head on the same machine.
Creating a loop.
Creating a repeating echo. The delay time depended on the distance between the heads and the tape speed. Or you could use multiple machines for longer, more complex delays. Brian Eno and Robert Fripp later developed this into Frippertronics, using two machines for very long, evolving loops.
And things like phasing and flanging, those swirly sounds.
Also came from tape, usually by playing two identical copies of a recording on two machines slightly out of sync, or by manually slowing down the flange of one tape reel slightly. The slight time difference created those characteristic sweeping comb filter effects.
It sounds like the Beatles used literally every tape trick in the book.
They really did, especially with engineer Jeff Emerick. They were constantly experimenting, cutting up tapes of Calliope music and splicing them together randomly for being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, recording piano or guitar solos slower, then speeding up the tape playback to make them sound faster and brighter.
And tape loops were huge for them, right? Tomorrow never knows.
Oh yeah, that track is built on multiple tape loops. They made Paul McCartney playing a distorted bass line, seagull sounds, orchestral snippets, some played backwards, all running simultaneously on different machines in the studio, faded in and out live on the console.
How did they even make the loops repeat smoothly?
Paul apparently discovered that if you disabled the erase head on a machine, you could just make a loop of tape, thread it through the machine, and it would continuously overdub itself. For Tomorrow Never Knows, they had these loops running all around the studio, held up by mic stands and pencils.
That sounds like beautiful chaos.
It was. They'd put bits of sticky tape on the capstan to create deliberate wow or pitch bends, like on Lovely Rita. They famously combined two completely different takes of Strawberry Fields Forever, recorded days apart in different keys and tempos, by cleverly adjusting the tape speed of both and finding one magical edit point where they could join them.
Wait, different keys and tempos? How is that even possible?
Pure studio magic and maybe a bit of luck. Jeff Emerick found a spot where, by speeding one take up slightly and slowing the other down slightly, the pitches and tempos miraculously align for a seamless crossfade. It's legendary.
And ADT, automatic double tracking.
Invented for them. John Lennon hated singing things twice for a double-tracked vocal sound. So Ken Townsend figured out how to use a second tape machine with a variable speed control, running slightly delayed against the first, to create an artificial doubling effect. Changed vocal production forever.
It's incredible how the limitations almost forced creativity.
Absolutely. Think of Delia Derbyshire painstakingly cutting and splicing individual sine wave tones to create the original Doctor Who theme at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Or the band 10cc using multi-track tape to layer hundreds of vocal overdubs to create that ethereal choir sound on I'm Not in Love.
Hundreds of overdubs on tape. The noise must have built up.
They had techniques to manage it, bouncing tracks carefully.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a huge undertaking. Pink Floyd made the loop for the cash register intro to Money by physically splicing together recordings of coins, registers, tearing paper onto one piece of tape and looping it.
So it wasn't just editing, it was sound design using tape itself.
Exactly. This physical manipulation is the heart of music concrete, the experimental tradition started by people like Pierre Schaeffer and Pierre Henry, using recorded sounds as raw compositional material. Frank Zappa was another master of tape editing and layering, creating incredibly complex pieces.
Are people still doing this kind of hands-on tape manipulation?
Some are, yeah. Experimental musicians like Aaron Dillaway or Jerome Nottinger use reel-to-reels as live performance instruments. You had bands like Mission of Burma incorporating take loops live back in the day. There's even a Japanese group called the Open Reel Ensemble that makes music using multiple old reel-to-reels as sound generators and processors.
The machine is the instrument. Wild. Okay, so eventually digital started taking over. Was there a digital tape phase?
There was, yeah. Kind of a transitional period before hard disk recording became affordable and reliable enough for multi-track audio. You had formats like Mitsubishi's Prodigy and Sony's DSH Digital Audio Stationary Head.
So digital recording, but on to tape reels.
Exactly. The idea was to get the benefits of digital no tape hiss, no wow and flutter, perfect copies, but using the familiar reel-to-reel transport. Nagra also made digital tape recorders for high-end film sound recording.
Did it solve all the problems of analog tape?
It solved the analog problems, yes. No hiss, ruler flat frequency response, no print through, no degradation over copies. But the tape media itself was very expensive. You still had to wind and rewind to find specific points, sequential access.
Still slow to navigate.
Right, and the tapes could still wear out physically. Plus, digital tape was incredibly sensitive to dust and dirt. A tiny speck could cause a dropout, and while they had error correction, sometimes poorly maintained tapes became unreadable over time because the errors overwhelmed the correction system.
Oh, not quite the perfect solution either.
Not quite. And as soon as formats like digital audio tape using smaller cassettes arrived, and then especially when hard disk recording became practical, those big digital reel-to-reel formats became obsolete pretty quickly.
But analog reel-to-reel, it stuck around.
It absolutely did,
yeah.
And its influence is undeniable. It fundamentally shaped modern recording practices, multi-tracking, editing, effects.
Yeah.
Laid the groundwork for so much.
And there's been a real resurgence in interest, hasn't there?
A huge one. Collectors love the machines, audiophiles love the sound. Many professional studios never abandon tape entirely or have brought it back. Artists actively seek it out for its specific sonic character and maybe even the workflow discipline it encourages.
Like who's using it now?
Oh, people like Jack White at Third Man Records is a big proponent of analog. The Foo Fighters famously recorded their whole album Wasting Light completely analog, straight to tape.
An entire modern rock album on tape. Wow.
Yeah. Tame Impala uses tape extensively. Producers like Steve Albini at Electrical Audio record tons of bands on tape. John Vanderslice's tiny telephone studio was known for its commitment to analog workflow. There are boutique record labels releasing new music only on reel-to-reel.
And even if people aren't using physical tape, the sound is still sought after.
Definitely. Look at hardware.
Yeah.
Teenage Engineering made a portable digital recorder, the TP7, that visually and functionally evokes a small reel-to-reel machine. It's tapping into that aesthetic.
And software.
Plugins.
Oh, massively. Tape emulation plugins are everywhere in digital audio workstations. Software models of classic machines like the Studer A800 or the Ampex ATR-102 or effects units based on tape delay.
Yeah.
Engineers use them constantly.
What do these plugins try to replicate?
They try to capture that subtle or not so subtle magic of tape.
Mm-hmm.
The gentle compression, the harmonic saturation that adds warmth or glue, the slight non-linearities, the characteristics of tape echo, even the wow and flutter, and yes, sometimes even adjustable levels of tape hiss. It's kind of funny, isn't it? Decades spent trying to eliminate tape's flaws, and now we have software designed to put them back in.
It really shows how those imperfections became part of the desirable character, part of the sound we associate with classic recordings. So, yeah, we've gone from Nazi Germany to Bing Crosby's radio shows to Siegfried Pepper's loops through Sticky Shed and Dolby, past digital tape, and landed right back with audiophile releases and software emulations.
It's clear reel-to-reel wasn't just a way to store sound. It was an active participant in creating the music. It shaped the workflow, inspired techniques, and left an indelible sonic footprint that we're still hearing and even recreating today.
Which leads to a really interesting thought for you, the listener, to maybe chew on. Think about how the very limitations of reel-to-reel tape, the fixed length of loops, the physical effort of splicing, the inherent noise floor, might have actually spurred creativity. Did those constraints force artists to find solutions, invent sounds they wouldn't have otherwise? And how does that compare to today, where digital tools offer almost infinite possibilities? Is there something lost, perhaps, when there are no limits?